From these ageless windows to the past, another window is opening to the humble but magnificent life of Mirza Abul Fazl Golpayi Ghani. Designated as an apostle of Baha'u'llah by the Guardian, he was the greatest scholar in the faith, whose writings rank second to the holy writings and the writings of Shoghi Effendi. When Abdu'l-Bahá was in Paris in 1913, he sent a cable to a believer in Cairo, where Mirza Abul Fazl was staying, stating that everything should be done for the comfort of Mirza Abul Fazl, who was as his own self. In memorial held after his passing, Abdu'l-Bahá stated, "In the servitude to the threshold of Baha'u'llah, he was my partner and associate." Who was this man? Every believer must know about his life and accomplishments and read his writings, which are studied extensively in the East for deepening as well as for proofs of the faith. He was born in 1844, the year of the declaration of the Bab, in the town of Golpayi Ghan, in central Iran. This town was founded by Huma, the daughter of Darius the Great. His name was Muhammad, and at the completion of his learning, he took the name of Abul Fazl, which means the father of knowledge. But Abdu'l-Bahá addressed him Abul Fazail, meaning the father of knowledges. In one tablet, Abdu'l-Bahá stated that he not only was the father, but the mother and brother of knowledge. In prime of his youth, he traveled to Isfahan and Iraq, a city in Iran, to perfect his studies in Persian and Arabic, and in his 20s, he acquired the knowledge of all sciences accessible to him. Many years later, one of his students gave the following account. In 1866, when Abul Fazl was 22 years old, the first edition of a comprehensive Arabic dictionary called Firuz Abadi was published in Tabriz. That time Abul Fazl was in Isfahan. A student brought a copy of that dictionary for Abul Fazl's criticism. It had 1,400 pages. In one evening, Abul Fazl looked it over and said two words had wrong accentuation, or i'rab. After a long and careful examination of the learned scholars in Isfahan, it was found that the statement of Abul Fazl was accurate. Imagine scanning 1,400 pages in one evening. By the time he was 29, his studies were completed, and in that year, that means 1873, he left his hometown of Golpayi Ghan and headed for Tehran. Short time after his arrival, he was appointed as the superintendent and professor in College of Hakim Hashem, the first-class Arabic college in Tehran. 3 years later, when he was at the height of his career, as the head of the Theologian College, a student approached him for help to answer an argument of a Baha'i, and being a scholar Muslim, he did his best and was quite content and proud that he had the answer to anything and everything. There was a merchant who had a shop in Bazaar who was a Baha'i, and his house used to be the place of meetings of seekers and teachers. His name was Abdul Karim Isfahani. In 1875, Abul Fazl became acquainted with him, but for a while did not know that he was a Baha'i, and occasionally used to visit at his shop. Then a small incident happened that changed the course of Abul Fazl's life. As it was customary that on Friday afternoon, which is the weekend in the East, to go to the countryside, Abul Fazl with a few clergy decided to go to the shrine of Shah Abdul Azim, which is in the outskirts of Tehran. On their way out, one of the donkeys lost a shoe, so they went to the nearest blacksmith, the shop of Ustad Husseini Naalband. Naalband means shoe fitter. Ustad Hussein was illiterate, and he saw the large turban of Abul Fazl, which indicated his vast knowledge, and so he was tempted to start a conversation as he was working on the shoe, like most barbers and hairdressers do. He said he was so honored that they went to his shop and wished to have permission to ask a question that had bothered him for such a long time. The permission was granted. He said, "Is it true that in a tradition of Shia Islam, it is stated that each drop of rain is accompanied by an angel from heaven, and that this angel brings the drop to the ground?" Abul Fazl said, "It is true." "Is it true that when there is a dog in a house, no angel ever visits that house?" Abul Fazl, not guessing the connection, affirmatively answered yes. "In that case, no rain should ever fall in a house where a dog is kept." All of a sudden, the great clergy was confounded by an illiterate blacksmith. His rage had no bounds, and his companions noticed his shame. They whispered to him that the blacksmith is a Baha'i. This incident left a deep impression on Abul Fazl. The blacksmith reported this incident to Abdul Karim and said that because Abul Fazl's pride was hurt, he might welcome an encounter with a Baha'i teacher to prove his own superiority. When Abdul Karim invited Abul Fazl to take part in a discussion with the Baha'i teacher, he accepted. The teacher was not highly learned, but quite spiritual, and answered all questions and arguments in simple but convincing terms. It may sound strange that uneducated people could be made a channel for the knowledge of God. Baha'u'llah states in Iran, "The source of all knowledge is God, and He bestows it upon those with pure heart." Detachment is essential for such sanctity of heart. It does not mean poverty or asceticism, but in particularly it is a detachment from love of self. Abul Fazl was surprised that he could not refute the arguments of someone who was not a learned man. He asked Abdul Karim to arrange a meeting with a learned Baha'i near his own caliber, so he could prove his own superiority and prove the falsity of claims of the Bab and Baha'u'llah. Abdul Karim was wise. He did not comply with his wishes because Abul Fazl's motive was selfish. In a few meetings, Abul Fazl was baffled by the simple arguments and the depth of understanding of these Baha'is about the mysteries of the holy books and Qur'an, and he was quite humbled and his pride hurt. Later on, he met with learned Baha'is in a meeting with Nabil-e Akbar or Fawzal-e Ghaini. At the end, he is quoted to say, "By God, no one could ever be found capable of withstanding the force of arguments of this great man of knowledge." To his own account, he spent about 8 months in these discussions, and now his purpose defeated and humble, he began to search after truth. He established close association with followers of all religions, and from friend and foe investigated the facts about the faith. He prayed day and night for guidance. Before reaching the final stage of certitude, he went through a great deal of intellectual struggle. His head accepted the facts, but his heart was not yet touched by the light of faith and assurance. The story of his reading Kitab-e Iqan is interesting. He recounted himself that he read it with an air of superiority and was not impressed by it, and even commented that if that book was the proof of Baha'u'llah's claim, he himself could write a better book. The following day, a prominent woman arrived at the college and asked for a scribe to write an important letter for her. The students referred her to Abu'l-Fazl as the outstanding writer. Abu'l-Fazl took up his pen but could not write the first sentence, and several times he scribbled on the corner and even drew a few lines on his fingernails, until the woman lost her patience and said mockingly, "If you have forgotten how to write a simple letter, why don't you say so, instead of keeping me waiting while you are drawing lines on your fingernails?" He states that he was overcome with feelings of shame as a result of this incident, and then suddenly remembered his remarks of the night before. This incident was a clear answer to his arrogance. When Abu'l-Fazl found himself utterly confounded by the proofs and arguments of both learned and unlearned Baha'i teachers, he entertained the idea that not until Baha'u'llah performed a miracle for him would his heart be satisfied. Baha'is explained that miracles could not be considered conclusive proof of the messengers of God, but Abu'l-Fazl insisted. He wrote a few questions on a paper, placed it in an envelope, sealed it with his own seal, and handed it to Abdul Karim for safekeeping. He then put another blank sheet of paper in another envelope and asked Abdul Karim to forward it to Baha'u'llah. He said, if his questions were answered, he would entertain no doubt about the truth of the cause. Abdul Karim and Abu'l-Fazl took both envelopes to the house of Haji Muhammad Ismaili Zabih so that the letter could be sent to Baha'u'llah. When they arrived, Haji was not home. His wife welcomed them, and they went inside, and they entered a room in which there were books and a chest containing the holy tablets. She gave them permission to open the chest and study the writings. Since Abdul Karim could not read, he asked Abu'l-Fazl to read to him. Abu'l-Fazl states, there was a tablet of Ra'is, Lohi Ra'is, addressed to Ali Pasha, who was the Prime Minister of Turkish Empire that time. But the tablet had been revealed in the honor of Haji Muhammad, who was their host. It was on a blue paper. He said, as I read it, I came across the story of the puppet show of Sultan Salim, which Baha'u'llah saw as a child in the wedding of one of his brothers in Tehran. As you recall, Baha'u'llah saw how the puppet man folded the puppets, including the Sultan and his ministers, and put them all in his suitcase. Abu'l-Fazl says, I was fascinated by it. Then I came across his following mighty words, quote, soon will we dismiss the one was like unto him, and will lay hand on their chief, meaning Sultan Abdul Aziz, who ruleth the land, and I verily am the Almighty, the All-Compelling, end of quote. Upon reading this, I was struck with awe and for half an hour became speechless. I contended in my own thoughts that Baha'u'llah has made these prophecies to mislead the ordinary people and keep his hold on his followers. Otherwise, it would not be possible for a prisoner to address the king who has imprisoned him and now was going to send him to the worst exile in such wrathful language. After all, he was a prisoner, single and alone, without any help. He says, while these satanic thoughts flooded my mind, yet I was grateful to God that I was never inclined to dislike him or be discourteous to him. I told Abdul Karim, to possess the power of life over created things is a miracle. I took my envelopes and tore them, and declared that the fulfillment of these prophecies would constitute the proof. I also had Abdul Karim promise and pledge to me that no more Baha'is would come to me and talk about the faith until these prophecies become fulfilled. I thought going to the house of Haji was an act of providence which relieved me from further discussion with these Baha'is. However, the believers did not comply and completely leave me alone and occasionally came to see me with their discussions. 5 or 6 months passed from the day I read the tablet. One day I saw two prominent Baha'is talking on the street. Trying to shun them, I pulled my abba over my head and tried to cross the street, but they saw me and called me by my name. They said, a telegram had arrived and it indicates the dethronement of Sultan Abdul Aziz, and the proof of word of God is established. This was a severe blow. I flared up with rage and said, it is not my concern. I am not his relative. But they reminded me my condition. I almost convulsed with rage and even did not say goodbye and left. I did not go to where I was planning to go and went straight home. Knowing the immensity of this test, I was overcome with emotion and tears uncontrollably flowed from my eyes. I begged God to assist me. In this condition, Abdul Karim came with two other people. I left the house and was in no shape to face them and did not return home until late. They left and came back in 2 or 3 days. I apologized for my behavior on that evening and said, now we must wait and see the prophecy, quote, we will lay hand on their chief, end of quote, be fulfilled. Since it does not mean natural death, he must be killed. By this time, the zeal for my finding the truth had reached its climax, and I found myself able to discover the mysteries of Quran. A few days passed, and the news of the assassination of Sultan Abdul Aziz was flashed by telegram. I went out of my mind. I was so agitated that even aimed a few blows at myself. At one time, I fought God. Another time, I would deny him. Then I would repent and beg him for assistance and guidance. I could neither eat or sleep. I only drank tea, smoked, and wept. One night, I was aroused from my slumber and began to admonish myself. That it has been about 1 year since you have been associating and arguing with these Baha'is. Even the uneducated ones have proven more depth in the mysteries than you, the so-called learned. Also, you have witnessed their characters and virtues. Why do you interpret their words as the breathing of the evil whisperers? Isn't that they are inspired and assisted by the Holy Spirit? I arose and performed my ablutions and said prayers. I then took the tablet of Ra'is, which had been in my possession long time, and began to read it tearfully. It was then when I heard the voice of God. I gained my certitude and felt such love and devotion towards Baha'u'llah that joy and ecstasy is indescribable. I knew that if I served those who guided me to the rest of my life, or to lay down my life in their paths, I could never repay them for giving me the spiritual life. Before dawn, I hastened to Abdul Karim's house and kissed the threshold of his door and prostrated at his feet. He was very embarrassed and said, "My behavior was not warranted, because God is the one who guides people and not the men." He was 32 years old when in September of 1876 he became a believer. While searching, he used to openly discuss Baha'u'llah's claim and forecast about Sultan Abdulaziz to his numerous students. Average person could never do this, but in his position as a scholar and a steadfast Muslim, there were no threats. But quite a bit of envy and jealousy on the part of the other clergy. As soon as he became a believer, he could not hide it anymore, and he was forced to resign and leave his position as the head of Tehran Theological College. And in December, by the order of Kamran Mirza, who was a prince and the governor of Tehran, Abulfazl was imprisoned, which lasted about 5 months. He and other Baha'is, through the intervention of Haji Mirza Hussein Khan, or Mushir-ud-Dowleh, who was the Minister of War, were freed. This great scholar earned his income by writing letters for the illiterate, enough to satisfy his hunger and the expenses of a donkey to take him around. He traveled to all parts of Persia and briefly was imprisoned in Hamadan and expelled from the city. He converted many people and deepened the believers. A few wealthy believers wished to deputize him to teach in their behalf and free himself from his struggle to earn his daily income. He thanked them and said he always relied on God for his needs. Many times his meal consisted of soaking a dry bread in water. On his traveling to teach, he used to stay in Karbansara and seldom staying with any of the friends. He served the faith for 40 years and was continuously in a state of prayer and devotion with complete detachment. In refusing any money from the believers, he wrote them that although at times the need necessitated selling of his clothes, but always God provided for him, and if people stopped sending money and letters to him necessitating answer, he could spend his time transcribing tablets and thus earning a living. He stated in another letter that Baha'u'llah has blessed him with these words, quote, "O Abulfazl, the All-Bountiful has been and will be with thee," end of quote. Tahir Zadi states, after he became a believer, he acquired such spiritual insight and faith seldom seen among the followers of Baha'u'llah. The reason for this was first the purity of his heart, which like a pure iron became fully magnetized by the spirit of Baha'u'llah. A few, if any, of the apostles of Baha'u'llah have surpassed him in qualities and perfections. The second reason was his vast knowledge, like an eye, was helped by the light of Baha'u'llah and discovered the mysteries invisible to ordinary man. He truly recognized the station of Baha'u'llah to a degree attained only by a few. With such recognition, he considered himself to be so unworthy that he felt unable to seek permission to attend the presence of Baha'u'llah. In 1882, when conversion of large number of people of nobility from every religion background alarmed the statesmen and caused envy and hatred of the clergy, new plots were made by the prince governor and the clergy, so a large number of prominent Baha'is were arrested, and in that process Mirza Abulfazl for 1 month was confined in the house of the governor. Several controversial meetings and debates were held in the presence of the governor. Great efforts were made by these enemies to get the order of Nasruddin Shah the king, for general massacre of all Baha'is to stop the process of conversion. But to satisfy them, the king said they could imprison Baha'is in chain and fetters. And this time, Mirza Abul Fazl was imprisoned for 22 months, 2 weeks of which he and 23 other prominent believers were kept in underground dungeon under heavy chains. And Abul Fazl states that for 6 months they received daily news of plots of enemies and expected death at any moment. After release, he had 7 months of peace in Qulhak, a resort place in outskirts of Tehran, when he was arrested and imprisoned by the prince for the third time. This one lasted 6 months, and he finally was released on February 5, 1886. It was in that year when he received a tablet from Baha'u'llah commanding him to travel. Baha'u'llah stated, quote, "To arise in his name and invite the people of the world to come to him so he could tell them the most great announcement, show them the most exalted horizon, and enable them to hear the voice of God." He was honored by Baha'u'llah in several tablets. At first, he was hesitant to write anything. He states, "In the early years of my conversion, I refused to write books because the supreme pen was moving. Finally, in 1887, when in Azerbaijan, I had the honor of meeting Varga the martyr, who encouraged me to write. Varga stated that while in Akka at the presence of Baha'u'llah, he heard Baha'u'llah encouraging the believers to write about the truth of the faith. Then, Varga said, I inquired if Baha'u'llah deemed it advisable to employ Mirza Abul Fazl in this service, and he said he has commanded it. In 1888, while in Hamadan, he states, I took the pen, and my first writing was answer to the questions of a Jewish doctor in Tehran. It is called Sharhe Oyote Muvarrakhe, which has not been translated into English yet. Soon after that, due to agitation of clergy, I was imprisoned for 5 days and expelled from that city. In those days, Baha'i teachers would employ 3 methods for proving the truth of the faith. First was based on rational and intellectual proofs. The second, on prophecies of the holy books, and the third method was used only in certain cases when a person did not wish to find the truth and wished to win the argument. This method was to use the arguments of that person to prove the case. Mirza Abul Fazl was expert in all 3 methods. One example of his dialogue with Reverend Dr. Robert Bruce, a British missionary in Isfahan, is interesting to listen. You need to know that in that time there was famine in Iran, and this missionary had political and financial influence on the government and the governor of Isfahan, and he was boasting about the above as well as his superior upbringing and education in the most advanced country, namely England. Here is the encounter between him and Abul Fazl. Abul Fazl, would you please tell me the extent of your contribution? Bruce, so far I have donated 500,000 tumans for famine, and if necessary, I could provide several times more. Abul Fazl, what is your political influence? Bruce, should fanatical Muslims close my church, I could direct a governor who is the son of the king, Zelo Sultan, to open it with his own hands. Abul Fazl, What are your educational qualifications? Bruce: I am graduate of a university from a foremost country. Abulfaz: Having so richly endowed with such influence and knowledge, how many souls have you been able to convert to Christianity since you came to Isfahan? You should know that they used to give attractive benefits to these converts. Bruce: About 30. Abulfaz: Of these, how many are steadfast and do sincerely believe? Bruce: After a brief pause, about 10 or 15. Abulfaz: Of these, how many will remain steadfast and are willing to give their lives in the face of persecution? Bruce: Perhaps 2 or 3. Abulfaz: With your permission, I wish to recount my position. I have no assets and at times have nothing to subsist on. My position and political influence is such that for being a Baha'i, I could be put to death with those killing me receive honor from the government. As to my knowledge, I received my education in religious schools, but I am the product of an ignorant and dark society. In spite of all of these shortcomings, I have spoken to about 100 people since my arrival in the city a month ago, and 24 souls among them have embraced the faith, and every one of them is willing to lay down his life as many other Baha'is have done. Now, in your fair judgment, who in this day is assisted by the Holy Spirit? You or I? Reverend Dr. Bruce had no answer. This was a simple checkmate made by Abulfaz. He later met Dr. Bruce in Tabriz, which is another story, on page 266 of the Revelation of Baha'u'llah, Volume 4, by Taherzadeh. In 1889, at the instruction of Baha'u'llah, Abulfaz moved to Ashgabat, which means the abode of love. It is in Turkmenistan, a province of Russia. There he met Captain Alexander Tumansky, an Orientalist who had befriended the believers, and his correspondence with the captain after Abulfaz moved to Bukhara and Samarkand are valuable readings. There in Ashgabat, 2 months after his arrival, he witnessed the events of the martyrdom of Haji Muhammad Isfahani, a prominent believer, and Abulfaz served as the Baha'i spokesman to the Russian government. This event took place in September of 1889. Following investigation and trial, the two who committed the murder were sentenced to death. The families and friends of these two murderers begged the believers and the family of the martyr for forgiveness. And consultation took place, and they asked the government to reduce the sentence. On the day of the execution, gallows were erected and the graves were dug. The prisoners were brought to the spot, and at the moment of execution, it was announced that the honorable Baha'is have interceded, and therefore the sentence has been reduced to exile to Siberia. Baha'u'llah made a reference to this in Lohe Dunya, or the Tablet of the World, and called it a princely act. However, later Abdul Baha stated that people have no right to forgive a criminal act, and the sentence must be carried for the protection of society. This event, which Abulfaz played an important role, increased the prestige of Baha'is and paved the way for initiation of enterprises such as schools, libraries, and the first house of worship. In Ashgabat, when Abulfaz read Baha'u'llah's tablet which had been revealed in his honor, he had no idea what Baha'u'llah meant by, quote, gazes upon the horizons, end of quote. Up to that time, his horizons have been limited to Iran and southern Russia. Within 2 years after the ascension of Baha'u'llah, the course of events showed him many new horizons. After Ashgabat, accompanying his teacher Nabil-e Akbar, he went to Bukhara, where shortly after Nabil-e Akbar passed away. Then he went to Samarkand. Both Bukhara and Samarkand are in Uzbekistan, a province of Russia. Lack of success in direct teaching and ascension of Baha'u'llah in 1892 put him in a quiet mood. As he walked in bazaars of golden Samarkand, studying the dusty books, he could not imagine that his future lay in the bustling cities of the West and not in the territories of Tamerlane or Timur Lang. In 1894, on instruction of Abdu'l-Bahá, he moved to the Holy Land. His spirit was galvanized when in Haifa for 10 months he basked in the sunshine of the Master, his love. The next 20 years of his life were filled with traveling, teaching, and writing. His first assignment was to go to Cairo, Egypt, where Al-Azhar University represented the school of higher Islamic learning. He, as instructed by Abdu'l-Bahá, did not openly talk about the faith. Being supposedly from Shia of Islam, from Iran, was enough handicap for him to be accepted. Soon he became known for his interpretation of religious scriptures, and scholars and professors of Al-Azhar, recognizing his depth, sat at his feet. Some believed he was endowed with divine powers. After he disclosed his religion, about 30 of these scholars became Baha'is. But the students who became Baha'is were immediately expelled from the university. One of the students, Badruddin Ghazi, recounted the following. He says, I thought Abul Fazl was a prophet, so one day I told him, Master, what is your station? He said, I have none. I said, why do you hide from me? If you are a prophet, please tell me, and I will accept and follow you. Abul Fazl laughed and laughed, and postponed the answer to a later time. After a while, I had to leave for Palestine. And Abul Fazl advised me to attain the presence of Abdu'l-Bahá. I obeyed and discovered the truth. There in Cairo, Abul Fazl corresponded with people of China, India, Russia, Iran, and Holy Land. Many of these were referrals to him by Abdu'l-Bahá for interpretation of scriptures or attack on the faith. The first explanation and discussion about the faith in the Middle Eastern press was by Abul Fazl in the popular Egyptian magazine Al-Mughattaf, which provoked severe objections by Muslim fundamentalists, which provided another opportunity for answer and further explanation. There, he wrote his famous book of Fara'id, which means The Matchless Gems, which was written in Persian in response to attack of a Muslim clergy from Caucasus and published in 1898. This book found little audience in Arabic-speaking Egypt. This book is about 800 pages and was printed from the very original draft without any addition on the margins or correction. This was the style and example of mastery of his writing ability. He became well known in Egypt, not only as the learned exponent of the faith, but also as the defender of Islam against missionaries. Then he wrote in Arabic, Durarul Bahiyyeh, which was published in 1900, and we have its translation in English under the name of Miracles and Metaphors. Actual meaning of Arabic name Durarul Bahiyyeh is the brilliant pearls, which was in answer to a learned from India. This book caused a fury. The clergy in Cairo issued a declaration which could have meant his death, hadn't it been for the British rule. In December of 1900, Abdu'l-Bahá sent Laura Clifford Barney, the compiler of some answered questions, to Egypt to accompany Abu'l-Fazl to the West.
Thank you.
After 3 months' stay in Paris, Abulfazl sailed for the U.S. It is interesting to mention that May Bowles, the mother of Amatul Baha Ruhi Khanam, who under the command of Abdul Baha insisted to stay in Paris, but her mother, who was not a believer, insisted that they should leave for vacation in England. The mother's request to Abdul Baha was denied. Then she asked for intercession of Abulfazl, who wrote a letter on her behalf, which also was denied. It was not until after Thomas Breakwell's Embracing the Faith in Paris when Abdul Baha permitted May to leave Paris. The reason Abdul Baha sent Abulfazl to the United States was to guard the early believers in the U.S. against the mischief of Khairullah. Khairullah was a charismatic Baha'i teacher who came to the United States in 1892. He made many new Baha'is, but was corrupted by his success. He wished to canonize his teachings, which were a mixture of Baha'i teachings and mystic and psychic concepts. He was disturbed when Abdul Baha did not agree and began to rebel and join forces with Muhammad Ali, the arch covenant breaker. Abdul Baha also sent Ali Ghuli Khan, Nabil al-Dawla, to translate for him. Mirza Abulfazl's stay in the United States was a few months short of 4 years. He held regular classes for the believers and seekers in Washington, D.C., New York, Chicago, Boston, and in Greenacre, where professors of philosophy from Harvard mingled with artists as well as the people of influence. Abulfazl towered above them all. He was not a public speaker or charismatic person, rather a reclusive scholar, but he filled the auditoriums of the U.S. with a large audience, all eager to partake of his knowledge. So impressed was Abdul Baha with the depth and ability of Abulfazl that he advised him to write a treatise explaining the faith and Ali Ghuli Khan to translate it. He was so humble that he claimed that the scope of such subject was beyond his ability. Ali Ghuli Khan stated that he pulled the Baha'i proofs out of Mirza Abulfazl. It was composed in Arabic under the name of Hujajul Bahiyyah, or the Baha'i proofs, which is the translation by Ali Ghuli Khan, is like an introduction to a much greater book which never was completed. It was first published in 1902, and this was his contribution for teaching the cause in a predominantly Christian society. In it, he explains the timeless truths of the faith, coming of the day of God, oneness of religions, also God being absolute unity beyond characterization. Being what it is, it remains an irreplaceable classic of Baha'i literature. He deepened the believers in the covenant and prepared them for visit of Abdul Baha. On November 29, 1904, the day he left the United States, he said, 32 years ago, when I left my hometown, I still was a Muslim. My mother, sister, and brothers gathered to say goodbye. 3 years later, when I became a Baha'i, they abandoned me and left me alone. Now consider the bounties of our Master, who has granted me hundreds of friends. The last 10 years of his life were spent in Egypt, in the cities of Cairo and Alexandria, with occasional trips to Beirut and Haifa. Reverend Peter Easton first visited Abdul Baha in September of 1911 in London, which followed by a venomous attack on the faith through articles in the newspaper Evangelical Christendom. Mirza Abul Fazl was then in Beirut. When informed by the students in the American University of Beirut about that article, from his sickbed he wrote one of his most effective writings called The Brilliant Proof or Burhani Lame. Abdu'l-Bahá received the first copy of it on June 19, 1912, the day he named the New York City the City of the Covenant. He praised it and ordered immediate translation of it. He was a genius in explaining subtle philosophical points, and he said he received that gift when Baha'u'llah in a tablet addressed to a believer in Isfahan wrote, quote, I beg of God to enable Fazl, means Abul Fazl, to teach his truth, that's capital H, to teach his truth and to unveil that which is hidden and treasured in his, again capital H, knowledge with wisdom and explanation. He was like an expert deep diver who would immerse in the writings of Baha'u'llah and discover gems and pearls easily missed by the rest. He was the first believer who, through logic and reason, showed that there were seven major religions before this dispensation. And the term seven heavens used by the prophets symbolizes those seven religions. He was the first to demonstrate with logic why the pagans, due to worshipping idols and images, are considered polytheistic, while their origin is one God. This parallel is easily found in some religions, such as Christianity, which is considering itself monotheistic. He was the first to establish genealogy of Baha'u'llah through research showing his descent from Zoroaster and Yazdegerd, the last king of Sasanid dynasty. The four books of his, which are translated in English, are the Baha'i Proofs, The Brilliant Proof, Miracles and Metaphors, and Letters and Essays. According to Balyuzi and Taherzadeh, two famed scholars, Baha'i history so far has not recorded anyone equal to Mirza Abul Fazl in learning, which was coupled with rare detachment and humility. His detachment, prayer, and meditations were the cornerstone of his life, and with them he polished the mirror of his heart so it perfectly reflected the light of the faith to those who came in contact with him. Abul Fazl stated that knowledge is nothing but comprehension of the reality of things, and the reality can only be reflected in hearts which are pure. That purity is attainable through prayer and spiritual concentration. To know his greatness and humility, Ali Ghuri Khan states, you had to watch him at the presence of Abdu'l-Bahá. His knowledge would reduce him to utter nothingness, like a pebble in the vast ocean shore. Isabel Fraser, who saw him frequently in Ramleh, a suburb of Alexandria, she wrote this about him after his death. With all his book learning, he was not at all bookish. The same dignity and impressiveness with which he discussed a verse of the Quran with the learned sheikhs he put into the meeting of some sojourning American, often finishing with a personal pleasantry, for he was a ready humorist and made his guests instantly at ease. He had the placidness of a child and the air of one who was never in a hurry and had plenty of time to make radiantly happy the place where God had placed him. One day, when I was at his house, there were about 20 sheikhs who had come over from Alexandria to visit him. One who seemed to be the leader was a very learned and gorgeously attired young sheikh, who said with some pride that he had been educated in the oldest university in the world, and he was the editor of a magazine in Alexandria and had come to interview Mirza Abul Fazl, who, for more than 1 hour, had been listened to with absorbed attention. His talk was interspersed with an occasional jest, and his sharp eye would glance from one face to another to see if his point was understood. Suddenly, Abdu'l-Bahá appeared. Mirza Abul Fazl faced the door. The rest of us had our backs to it and did not see him. There was a moment of silence, and Mirza Abul Fazl stood with his head bowed. His whole attitude changed. He immediately became the most humble and respectful of the servitors. Then, quickly arranging a chair for Abdu'l-Bahá, he told him in a low voice, in answer to his questions, the subject under discussion. His steadfastness in the covenant and obedience to Abdu'l-Bahá had no bounds. He would rather die than to think of small deviation from the teachings and laws. One believer, Hossein Ruhi, said, "When I arrived in Egypt, I shared the Lohe Dukhan, or the Tablet of Purity, with Abul Fazl. I had not yet finished reading of the tablet when he threw his cigarette case in the street and said, that was the end of smoking for him." Abul Fazl was a chain smoker, rolled his own cigarettes, and lit a new one with the old. He said that he has been smoking for 55 years and was addicted, and said, "Soon you will see that a member of my body will become paralyzed." It did not take very long when one of his arms became paralyzed, which lasted for 2 years. The doctors strongly urged him to resume smoking, but he refused, saying he preferred to die than disobey Abdu'l-Bahá. That tablet does not forbid smoking. Abdu'l-Bahá states in it, quote, "Smoking tobacco, which is dirty, smelly, and offensive, is an evil habit which is highly injurious to the health," end of quote. To the end of his life, this solitary man, though grown frail, was busy with his research and writing. In 1910, when Abdu'l-Bahá chose Ramleh, a suburb of Alexandria, for rest, he rented a house near his own residence for Abul Fazl. Abul Fazl loved his quiet life in Alexandria, the life of books and ideas. When some American ladies on pilgrimage insisted on visiting Abul Fazl frequently, he dealt with them with consideration and humor. These ladies would call from the porch, "Oh, Abul Fazl, we wish to see you." An elderly voice from inside would answer, "Abul Fazl is not here." In January 1913, from Paris, Abdu'l-Bahá cabled a well-known believer in Cairo that everything should be done for the comfort of Abul Fazl, who he said was as his own self. In June of that year, while in Port Said, Egypt, Abdu'l-Bahá was disturbed by the news of Abul Fazl's continued illness, and sent his son-in-law and another believer to Alexandria to see everything was done for Abul Fazl. Few days before Abdu'l-Bahá's departure from Egypt for the Holy Land, Abul Fazl went to Cairo. In January, which is the coldest month in Cairo, his strength failed rapidly, and when confined to bed, was transferred to the house of one of the believers who used services of the best doctor and nurses. Mirza Abul Fazl died on January 21st, 1914, at 4 p.m. at the age of 70. The nurse in attendance said his final words were, خدا خدا, God God. With these words of greetings, he joined the one in whose service he labored for so many years. He was laid to rest next to the grave of Leo Getzinger in Cairo Cemetery. Next day, the news was given to Abdu'l-Bahá in Haifa as he sat down for lunch. He did not say a word. He arose without eating and went to his room, where he stayed alone until late in the afternoon. In the evening, when the believers gathered in Abdu'l-Bahá's house, he received them and spoke to them about Mirza Abu'l-Fazl. But it was frequently interrupted with silence when he was flooded with emotion. He spoke with his eyes closed. In another day, he stated how erudite and learned Abu'l-Fazl was. He had the knowledge of the books, of all religious books, and the intricate laws and customs of many countries in the East and the West. He knew the doctrines of every sect and party. In the servitude to the threshold of Baha'u'llah, he was my partner and associate. During the hours of grief, he was the source of my consolation. In his humility, he lived in the station of nothingness. I never heard the word I from him. While weak and sick, he refused to accept a servant and would prepare tea himself for his visitors. He had been imprisoned several times, but I never heard him about his hardship. The only time he spoke was about the praise of Mullah Rizawi Yazdi, that how eloquently he presented the faith to the prince governor. No matter how much we want to console ourselves, we cannot. While in Alexandria, every time my heart was depressed, I used to go and meet him, and at once my depression vanished. He was very truthful. He never harbored deceit or revenge. What an honor for Mirza Abu'l-Fazl to have such exalting eulogy by no less a person than Abdu'l-Bahá himself. Indeed, it was a well-deserved bounty. Abdu'l-Bahá named a door in the shrine of the Bab after his name, and the guardian designated him as one of the 19 apostles of Baha'u'llah. Only if we could emulate his humility. Thank you. Considering the immensity of three tablets of Baha'u'llah and their grave effect on the faith of the three most powerful officials of Turkey and the mighty Turkish Empire itself, prompted me to make this addendum to the talk on Mirza Abu'l-Fazl. The part mentioned in the talk about the tablet of Ra'is and how the fulfillment of its prophecies brought unshakable certitude to Mirza Abu'l-Fazl was what Mirza Abu'l-Fazl had told Haji Mirza Haydar Ali, who later recounted it. The tablet of Ra'is mentioned in that part was a general term used by Haji Mirza Haydar Ali for three momentous tablets revealed by the pen of glory within the span of 2 to 3 years, addressing the two highest ministers of the Turkish Empire. Ali Pasha was the prime minister, called by Baha'u'llah Ra'is or chief, and Fuad Pasha was the foreign minister. These two men alternatively changed the two positions. Also, a few words about the title of Zabih, meaning sacrifice conferred by Baha'u'llah to two believers, will identify the two individuals. One believer was Sayyid Ismaili Zawari, the erudite believer who in Baghdad, after seeing a glimpse of Baha'ullah's glory, ended his own life. The other was Haji Muhammad Ismaili Kashani, the brother of Haji Mirza Jani, the first Babi in Kashan, who hosted the Bab in his house for 3 nights and later was martyred. The other title of Haji Muhammad Ismail is Anis, which means companion, also conferred by Baha'ullah. He was the one in whose house the 3 well-known tablets of Baha'ullah were perused for the first time by Mirza Abul Fazl. After passing of Zabih, Baha'ullah wrote to his son that Haji Muhammad Ismail wished to offer his life in the path of God, and in the sight of God he has the station of a martyr, and thus was honored with the title of Zabih. Now about the 3 tablets, Surah Ra'is, Tablet of Ra'is, and Tablet of Fu'ad, and the summary of their contents. This summary is extracted from the Revelation of Baha'ullah by Tahir Zadeh, Volumes 2 and 3. Haji Muhammad Ismail, or Zabih, arrived in Adrianople in August of 1868, when Baha'ullah's house was surrounded by soldiers, as the first step towards his exile to Akka. Zabih could not attain the presence of Baha'ullah, so he wrote a letter to him. Surah Ra'is was revealed in Arabic while Baha'ullah was on his way to Gallipoli to be shipped to Akka. It was revealed in the honor of Zabih, but was addressed to Ali Pasha, the Prime Minister of Turkey. With Baha'ullah's permission, Zabih attained his presence in the public bath in Gallipoli. The first part of this surah is addressed to Ali Pasha, whom Baha'ullah calls Ra'is, severely rebukes him for causing all of the tribulations to the believers and cruel injustice to Baha'ullah. Further, he identifies Ali Pasha with those who denied the manifestations of the past and declares how this cause before long will encompass the world. He predicts that Adrianople would pass out of their hands and blood would flow everywhere. The second part of this surah is in response to a question by Zabih about the nature of the soul. A few months after the revelation of Surah Ra'is, in the early stage of his imprisonment in a cell in the barracks of Akka, and soon after the death of 3 of his followers, the momentous Tablet of Ra'is, or Lohe Ra'is, was revealed in Persian and addressed to the same Prime Minister, Ali Pasha. In it, Baha'ullah refers to Ali Pasha as the one who considers himself to be the most exalted among men, and Baha'ullah as the lowest servant. He admonishes him for his cruelties in committing number of innocent people, including women and children, to the harsh life of that grim prison, and how the first night of their arrival they were denied food and water. Remember, it was on an extremely hot and windless day of August, which took the sailboat all day to cross the bay from Haifa to Akka, and there was no shade and inadequate water to drink. In this tablet, Baha'ullah recounts that as a child he attended the wedding of one of his brothers in Tehran, where he saw the puppet show about Sultan Salim, and how he watched with curiosity the puppet man at the end, folding up the Sultan and his men, putting them all in a suitcase. Then he counsels him not to rely on his pomp and glory, as they will soon be coming to an end. He emphatically warns him that God's chastisement will assail him from every direction, and how confusion will overtake his people, the government, and he will never be able to repent or make amends. It is interesting that after revealing this tablet, Baha'u'llah scribe Mirza Aghajan asked him that what would happen if Ali Pasha truly repented. Baha'u'llah stated that every word would inevitably be fulfilled and all the people of the world would be unable to change one word of that tablet. Now about Lohe Fuad or Tablet of Fuad. Fuad Pasha was the foreign minister and collaborator with Ali Pasha in exiling Baha'u'llah to Akka in 1868. He was dismissed in 1869, 1 year after revelation of Surah Ra'is, and subsequently died in France. In early years in Akka, Baha'u'llah revealed the Tablet of Fuad and in it declared that God had taken his life as punishment and described in strong terms the agony of his soul. In this tablet, Baha'u'llah prophesied the downfall of Ali Pasha and Sultan Abdul Aziz in the following terms, quote, "Soon will we dismiss the one who was like unto him," meaning Ali Pasha, "and will lay hold on their chief who ruleth the land," meaning Sultan Abdul Aziz, "and I verily am the Almighty, the All-Compelling," end of quote. Shortly after the revelation of the Tablet of Fuad, Ali Pasha, the Prime Minister, was disgracefully dismissed from his position and died in 1871. 5 years later, Sultan Abdul Aziz, as prophesied in the Tablet of Fuad, was dethroned and imprisoned by the revolutionaries and was killed a few days later. And then, in the disastrous war of 1877-78, the Russians and their Bulgarian allies reached the gates of Constantinople, at one time the powerful capital of the Turkish Empire. No one could have fathomed that such invincible empire would soon crumble and form the independent countries on today's map. As foretold 10 years earlier in Surah Ra'is, Adrianople was occupied by the enemy and truly blood flowed everywhere. No wonder that these fulfillments were more than a miracle to Mirza Abul Fazl and brought him the bounty of immovable conviction. Let us be fair in our judgment and reflect on these mind-boggling events and recognize the power which elevated Mirza Abul Fazl to the highest station of certitude and servitude.